Hello, and welcome to the Original Content Podcast. I'm Anthony Ha.
And I'm Jordan Crook.
And it is just the two of us today, but I'm excited to be here with you, Jordan.
Yeah, we have this rotating extra host, and I enjoy everyone who comes on the show, but I feel like we could do a little stripped-down version, just me and you getting to the nitty-gritty, you know what I mean? I feel good about it.
I agree. Once in a while, we got to get rid of those other people, because they're not that important.
They're superfluous, you know?
Absolutely. So this week, as we always do, we're going to go over some of the recent streaming and entertainment news, and then we're going to do a review. I think our most in-depth portion of the review is going to be about this Netflix show, Evil Genius, but then we're also going to use that as an opportunity to maybe talk about some of the recent true crime shows that you've been watching, right, Jordan?
Yeah, no, I've been like absolutely into that whole category. I've been going through show after show, so we can talk a little bit about Unabomber. I watched that docuseries called The Staircase, and then I've also just finished the first season of Mindhunter. So I'm, wow. Like I said, I'm tearing through it.
You're going deep.
I'm really into it right now.
All right, we'll get to that in just a second. Let's start with one of the big pieces of news this week, which isn't 100% confirmed yet, but it's been getting a lot of coverage, is this show Veronica Mars, which I was certainly a fan of when it aired about a decade ago. Is potentially going to be revived on Hulu. Were you a fan of Veronica Mars?
Yeah, so that's interesting because I remember Veronica Mars like vividly. Like I remember people being really into it. I remember seeing it on TV a lot. Like I remember the reruns airing a lot too. Like I think it was syndicated at some point.
Yeah,
but I could never do it. And I'm a huge fan of is it Kristen or Kirsten? I guess I'm Kristen. Not that big of a fan. Kristen
Bell. I wasn't going to say anything.
I really like her, though. I really do. Like, I like, especially, like, some of the movies and stuff she's been in. And I like her relationship with Dax Shepard in terms of, like, celebrity gossip and stuff is always really fun to watch. But, yeah, I didn't care. I just couldn't find myself into Veronica Mars for some reason.
I would say that I found that the first season in particular, I mean, it was on UPN and then on the CW, and so those were 22-episode seasons, which I think now just feels so long, particularly for a show that, you know, has this sort of central mystery. And so I thought the first season was actually pretty perfect. I mean, there's definitely, I'm sure if I go back now, there are episodes where you're like, why are they worrying about this, like, mini mystery when there's, like, this bigger, like, serial killer or, like, murderer on the loose or whatever? But that first season was so good. And then the second and third seasons I was not as crazy about because it's one of those things where it's a show that has, like, one story. It told that story. And then it kind of, because that's how the business works, had to come up with new stories. And none of the follow-up stories were as interesting. And then they did this movie that came out a couple years ago that they kickstarted. And I remember I was super excited about that just because it was like all the, you know, creative team getting back together and Kristen Bell and the stars. And that movie just did nothing for me. I really did, like, you know, like I thought, like, it was just, it was bad. It was really disappointing. Not like in the sense that that like the writing was just like, it was like badly made, but there was just no point in it sort of existing. And it just felt kind of like, it was like, oh, like this is, I guess what I wanted, but maybe I didn't really want it after all. I think I wrote a post for TechCrunch about this, about like this weird,
like a little labored.
Yeah. And just this thing of like, it's better sometimes to let something like, you know, just be like, that was great. There's no need to bring it back.
That's how I feel about, like, the potential for, like, I mean, this will never happen. Like, I could probably 100% guarantee that this will never happen. But, like, a Friends reunion, like, people talk all the time about, like,
right,
what if they made a movie or they made, like, one season or, like, a little mini series that, like, brought the Friends back together and showed us where they were. Like, the idea of that, like, I want that so bad. But at the same time, I know that I would be so upset by it. You know what I mean? Like, it just wouldn't. It's like disrupting the canon. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, exactly. That. Right, right. And so I think, like, you know, I mean, that said, I think if the, you know, the right person, you know, if the creators feel like they have a new story to tell, then, and I think Rob Thomas, who, not the Rob Thomas from Matchbox 20, but, you know, he was the creator of Veronica Mars. He also made iZombie, which is, I think is a really fun show. But if he feels like he's got like a great story to tell, then I'm like not, I'm going to check it out, right? I'm like interested in seeing it, but I'm also very concerned that like it's just going to, in the same, I'll get that same feeling that I got watching the movie of just being like, eh, this is fine, but I feel like you're sort of taken away from what was special about the original show.
Yeah, I agree with what you're saying. I also think that, like, there's something to be said for the fact that, like, a lot of these mystery television shows have gone to, like, either anthology or, like, right. the, I don't know even what you call it, serialized, like, with American Horror Story, right? Like, we get something completely new every season, because I think it's really hard to keep the same people going in a mystery crime type situation, detective situation, unless it's like highly procedural, like you look at like Law and Order and stuff, and even all those have kind of faded out, or it's serialized in some way, you bring in new stories and new characters. And I also thought it was interesting what you said about like a 22 episode season, like even like the biggest shows, like primetime, like This Is Us, for example, which runs for like the full year, even that is like down to like, I think 13 or 14 episodes.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's interesting. We're watching an evolution of television right before our eyes, obviously. Otherwise this wouldn't be a podcast.
Exactly.
All right. So British Bake Off though.
Right. So that's, the Great British Bake Off, which, I think in the US is apparently known as the Great British Baking Show for legal reasons, which is also kind of hilarious. Is moving from PBS to Netflix in the US. I honestly have not seen the show, but I've heard like that it's actually amazing.
Yeah, no. So I so one night Maria came home, she works as a bartender, and she came home and she was like, I really want to watch the British Baking Show. And I had no idea where this came from. She was like, yeah, one of my bartender friends really loves it. It's just like the least expected thing you hear, But and we started watching it, and like the first four seasons, I think, are on Netflix.
Yeah, right, I think now, that's right.
The older ones. And I will say that I have some hesitation because I don't know the exact details of it. But as it when it first launched, it had these two co-hosts. These two women who had been like MCs and comedians and like television kind of personalities for a long time, and their chemistry and their delivery and kind of the way that they ran the show is just so flawless. And then they had, I think his name's Paul Hollywood. They had Paul and they had Mary Berry as the judges, which is like, if you think about it from a US perspective, like it's really weird to have two hosts and two judges on one of these types of shows. Like normally you have like three judges who are also hosts, or you have like one host and like five judges, or you know what I mean? It's just like a really weird,
it's confusing. Yeah. It's
yeah, just kind super of a weird format
balance.
Yeah. But it worked, and it was so, so good. Like little things down to like the way that they, you know how like on these cooking shows with like Top Chef and stuff, they like show like an aerial view of the plate, and then they do like, you know, this is what's on the plate, and they do a little like they write out what's there and stuff. Like on the baking show, they did this really cool thing where they did these spinning shots of it, and then they also did this animated journal entry of what the person plans to make and like drew a picture of it. I don't know, it's just little tiny things. And the fact that they did the whole thing in this, you know, park or whatever it was, like these Tudor mansions, and these beautiful green spaces under a tent, like just little things made it really fun. And I think the cherry on top of all of that, or rather not even the cherry, like the glue honestly that held it all together, was Mary Berry. I think she made it the show because she's like this ancient woman who clearly knows what she's talking about, but also like the what she got excited about and what she didn't like and did like, and everything down to the way she took a bite of food was just like so perfect and funny and awesome. So I'm hesitant. I love the show. I think it's great. And I think it's super fun, and it's cool to see all the cool stuff that they can come up with. I love the format, but I am hesitant about new characters. You know, I got really attached to the, it's like trying to do, Hell's Kitchen without Gordon Ramsay. You know what I mean? Like, it's like, that wouldn't be a show, you know? So it's like, I don't know.
Right. So we should say, I believe that Paul Hollywood is the one returning member of the original lineup.
Yeah.
And then other than that, it's basically new hosts and a new judge.
Yep. So that concerns me because I think Paul is like definitely the least likable person on the show. In fact, like
what kind of name is that too?
And I don't think we should like throw around accusations about people at all. But I think that like Paul, just his vibes felt very, let's just like misogynistic, maybe. Like, I don't know. He was just like, he gave like instinctually, I'm not sure at all if he could be like a teddy bear, but like my sense of him was that he was like a creepy dude who I wouldn't want to be alone in a room with, you know?
Right.
So,
which, and again, we're not saying anything about his like behavior in private life, but just sort of like his personality on like the vibe he gives off on screen.
Exactly. And it's also like not necessarily his actions. It's like my perception of his actions. Yeah. But like you learn as a woman to trust those things a little bit. But anyway, we can come back to that some other time. anyway, I'm excited that it's coming back. I'm glad that they're putting effort into it. I think it's a huge success. And if you haven't seen the first four seasons, even if you're not into cooking shows and stuff, like it's one of those, if you come back after a night of going out with your friends, you've been drinking, you're having some snacks on the couch and you just want something really chill and light and fun, like that is the show, like 100%. It's super good. Encourage everyone to watch what is existing on Netflix. I don't know about this. I'm glad that they're investing in it, but it's on shaky ground without those other characters, I think.
Well, I heard it like that it sort of has it's not exactly the same thing, obviously, but has some of the same appeal of Terrace House, which we talked about earlier this year. That it's like it's a reality show, but it's not in that sort of American style where everything is about conflict and drama, but it's much more chill.
Yeah, absolutely. Like there is almost no drama. In fact, because they're British and they're so polite, like there was one episode where they were making like a la mode or something. They were making something that required like ice cream, like a lot of cooling and heating of different elements of the dish, right? And like this one guy put in his ice cream to freeze and the girls moved it out of the freezer and his stuff melted and he like completely failed the challenge because of it. And he was like, it's too bad, unfortunate, you know? And it's like, if that had happened on an American cooking show where like someone had like, I mean, and I don't even think they purposefully sabotaged him. They were just like, oh, I gotta find room for my stuff, you know? That would have ended in like just fighting and throwing things and like a knife being pulled. You know what I mean? Like, but they were just like, oh yeah, whatever, unfortunate. So there's no drama at all. Even when you're like, man, there should really be some drama around this. There's no drama. So it's like, it's a good feeling show. Like the thing you could be saddest about is when the character you really like or the competitor you really like, you know, messes up and gets eliminated. That's hard to watch. But other than that, it's like all good feels all around.
Yeah. Great. Well, let's move on to something that does not have a lot of good feels, which is Evil Genius, which is a Netflix series. It actually came out a few months ago, but like, you know, part of like Netflix's strategy, it just puts out so much stuff. So I think we're kind of just, at least I'm only coming around to it right now, partly on your recommendation. How did you find it?
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, I think it was very much around the algorithm, right? Because like I started, so like let's rewind a little bit. So when Sharp Objects came out, Sharp Objects has had a huge effect on me, and the finale is coming out this Sunday. So we should really plan to have it as our next episode where we
let's go do it.
I don't absolutely know if that'll be next week because I think I'm getting on a plane to go to
Yeah, we'll figure out the timing. We'll do an in-depth Sharp Objects episode sometime soon.
It's like necessary. But Sharp Objects like really like spurred something in me where I was like, man, this like dark but also Sharp Objects is in a class of its own, so I can't even relate Evil Genius or any of this other stuff to it. But it definitely made me be like, oh man, these crime, mystery, murder things. I was like really into it. I wanted something like Making a Murderer, and a friend recommended The Staircase, which we can talk about a little bit. And then I think after watching The Staircase and like dabbling in a couple other things, the Netflix was like, oh, Evil Genius. And I did ask another friend about it, and he was like, yeah, I saw Evil Genius. It's really good. So I tried Evil Genius. But I think a lot of it came down to the more you watch of something, the more Netflix wants you to look at all the other shit that they have on it. So, Evil Genius, just for context for you guys. And I really, like, I don't exactly know when this crime happened, but
I think it was 2003.
So that makes me 15 when it happened. So I probably should have paid a little bit more attention to it, but I forgive myself for not having been like completely wrapped up in it at the time. But do you remember
no, the Pizza Bomber? Yeah. And I was in college at the time. So I think like this is true now too, that I pay a lot of attention to political news. Now obviously I pay a lot of attention to tech news and then entertainment news, but I never really followed like crime news except unless it was like huge. And I kind of get the sense that this was big, but not like OJ big, you know, like it was something that was on the news, but wasn't like necessarily front page of New York Times news.
Yeah, I think it was probably like visited by the national news every time there was like a big break in the case, but it's like a 4-minute segment on an hour long national news show.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? Like, I don't think anybody really, I mean, I could be wrong about that. I wasn't paying attention. Lord knows I was 15.
Playing at, you know, and I wasn't watching the nightly news in college. Like I was like, you know, going to like New York Times, like, or something like that, but like not watching like TV newscasts.
Exactly. So the point is, we both missed this, but there was a truly bizarre crime.
Yeah, it's crazy.
In 2003. Like a truly, like, mind-bogglingly bizarre crime. So what we know of the beginning is that there's this guy who robs a bank. He has what appears to be a bomb strapped to his neck, but he's a pizza delivery guy. And the police apprehend him, and he's sitting on the street, and the bomb goes off. And people are like, what the hell is this whole thing, right? And as you unfold the mystery of this, it becomes even weirder. Like, the pizza guy really didn't seem to have any connection or reason to rob the bank. He had this shotgun that was meant to look like a cane for walking that he also had alongside the bomb. Like, when he was sitting there with the bomb on his neck and the police were trying to talk to him, he was like, you know, I didn't, this isn't my bomb, like, get it off me, I think it's going to go off, and I don't know, man, the whole thing was weird. Okay, so you take it from here.
Okay.
Because you watched it more recently than me.
Yeah, so let's see, what can we, I mean, I think one thing that's fairly clear from the beginning is that this woman, Marjorie Diehl Armstrong, and this is not a spoiler, because literally the documentary opens with Marjorie Diehl Armstrong, who's this woman who is clearly very, very intelligent and ultimately, like, sort of gets implicated in some related crimes, and as a result of that, ends up...
No, because a guy was murdered. A guy was murdered, like a block and a half away from where all this happened. A guy was found in an icebox in a basement.
Right. Basically, this other person, whose name I can't remember right now, he calls the cops and says, Marjorie has killed this guy and forced me to keep him in my freezer. This guy
is also like 6'2", right? Like, nobody's forcing him to do anything, but okay.
Right. So part of what happens is, and so it's very clear that there's basically these two people who in some way are connected to both of these crimes. I mean, there's no question that are connected to, because it's, you know, this freezer, this body in this guy's freezer. But also there's like clearly some, like the fact that this happened at the same time, just down the road from this bank robbery and collar bomb crime, there's clearly some connection. And basically what the show is kind of spelling out is, or trying to explore, is exactly what that connection is. And part of it is also like that there are these two, both very intelligent people who have had this sort of complicated on and off romantic relationship for like the last few decades. And now at this point, both of them are basically pointing the finger at the other and saying like, this person was like the mastermind behind these crimes. This person, like, made me an accomplice. But it's, like, very confused because at the same time they kind of don't want to admit they're involved in these crimes at all, particularly the bank robbery. But then, like, when it kind of becomes clear that they can't completely deny involvement, then they immediately start pointing the finger at each other.
Yeah, and, like, the real – what's interesting, I think there's two pieces of this documentary that are interesting. The filmmaker clearly understood kind of – I think at the end he had made his mind up about who was the mastermind, and – he could have told the story, like, it's all about what is revealed when, right? Like, the first 15 minutes of this, like, yeah, you hear about Marjorie, right, a little bit, and you, like, have an idea that she's involved. But then you immediately kind of almost forget all of that because you see this guy, and the first 15 minutes, I will say that the first 15 minutes where we're dealing with this guy with the collar bomb on are really stressful for me because he, like, seems really calm. He seems to have, like, you know, be like, oh, they'll figure this out. They'll figure out this wasn't my choice. They'll figure out I wasn't involved. They'll get this thing off me. It'll be fine. And then the bomb starts ticking and he starts freaking out. He's like, this thing is actually going to go off. You guys got to, you have to do something. You have to do something. And it goes off. And, like, I don't, that was just so, and then you're like, what the hell is happening here? We've got a pizza guy robbing a bank. And every step from there, everything is revealed in such a great, you know, kind of interesting, confusing way that it really compelled me, at least, to keep watching. But then I think the other thing is the idea of, like, you know, trying to unpack these people, especially when the guy, the male counterpart in this twosome, died, right? Like, shortly after.
Right.
And just, like, what's weird about it is, like, you have these two really smart people and they wanted to rob a bank for whatever reason. There are a bunch of ways to do that. You know what I mean? Like, there are a bunch of ways to do that, but the way that they chose to do it was so, like, almost overly complicated, you know? And that to me was interesting, like, the kind of psychology behind two people who choose to, like, bring in this third party. The bomb itself was made, like, in a way that had all of these, like, if you touch this, it will explode. If you trip this, like, it was made with all of these kind of booby traps within it. Like, clearly these people are really, really smart, but they almost, like, thought themselves into trouble, it feels like. I don't know. It was bizarre. The whole thing, the story itself, if you haven't, like, looked into the whole pizza bombing thing, it was just, it is the most bizarre thing I think I've ever heard of in terms of a crime. Like, I just can't wrap my head around it. But what did you think? Like, what, I mean,
I felt like the core story was just insane, like, in a good, like, in this, you know, this way of, like, wow, like, I can't believe I missed this. It's, like, crazy to think that this is a real thing that happened, because it feels like something from a fictional film. And just this idea of this, like, person who would do this to somebody else is really you know, I think, like, is just kind of mind-boggling. And so I think the core, I enjoyed, I mean, I'm glad I watched, I mean, enjoy is sort of a tough word, I think, to use when talking about these shows, because, you know, there were real people who died here, and so it's, but at the same, and I mean, that's part of the weird thing about, I think, true crime in general, is that obviously part of the reason you're watching is for enjoyment, but that enjoyment has to be sort of tempered by the knowledge that, oh, like, this is somebody else's, like, pain, essentially, that you're watching right now.
Well, I think, like, part of the enjoyment, quote unquote, or, like, the entertainment value of this is that, like, the vast majority of people on this planet do not think the way that these mastermind criminals do.
Right.
And we're, I think, if you're an open-minded person, you're always interested in what the other is like, you know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. how can you do that? How can you get yourself in a mind space for that? Why, how can you even in your mind kind of dream up this sort of plot? And one thing that was interesting is that this duo, Marjorie and her man,
Bill Rothstein,
they involved, like, two or three other people. And I'm pretty sure that those two or three other people did not realize what they were doing. So, like, beyond just bringing in this pizza guy, there are other parties involved that they, like, that that, think about the confidence, right? Like, think about the level of confidence that you have to involve other people to tell them we're going to rob a bank or we're going to pull a prank or whatever it is that they told them and actually go through with it. It's just something that I can't understand. I think I'm a pretty confident person, but I can't understand that level of confidence. Do you know what I mean? And like that, I think, is where the entertainment value comes. It's from trying to like understand how the mind of someone like that works. It just, it's weird and crazy. And I am interested in it. I just can't not be, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think like part of like the show is, I think, both, it's trying to be both a mystery story, and you're seeing sort of the mystery unfold, even though I think sort of in some way a lot of the solution is kind of apparent already because they introduced Marjorie from the beginning, but like how all the dots connect is like wild, and so it's just a completely compelling story in that way. And then it's also trying to be this sort of psychological portrait of Marjorie and Bill, and I think in that case I was a little bit less I don't think it quite worked as well because probably just because those, because they're, you know, to a large extent, I mean, so both of them have died in the present day. Bill dies, you know, about a year after the crime. Marjorie actually has a relationship with one of the directors of the series, but she's in prison. So she, like, all of her conversations are sort of, you know, tape recorded audio only. And she tends to go into this mode of just like ranting. Like, it's not really like interviews, she just kind of rants.
But I think even that's interesting, which we can touch on. Remind me to bring that up when we talk a little bit about Mindhunter, because like the fact that you can tell someone, essentially at one point this director is talking to her, and when Anthony says relationship, he means like a professional relationship. Like, she knew that a film crew was coming in to tell this story, and she thought, again, the confidence, she thought that she could convince them to do like a Making the Murderer style thing where they're going to defend her or something, you know, even with all this evidence. And when presented with evidence saying like, we know that it was you, she's like, I can't believe you do this to me. You know, she still sticks to her guns. And I just like that in that way, I agree with you that it was a little bit weird and off.
Right.
To have like such direct access to Marjorie. And I think that if Rothstein were still alive, it would have made a difference if he could have talked to both of them to play them off one another. I think that was like an unfortunate situation for the makers of the show. But having her, I think that extra layer, because eventually it all unravels. I think like it's 4 episodes. And I think by like the end of the second episode, like everyone's mind's pretty much made up, but it's having that extra layer of Marjorie kind of like still squirming that makes it interesting. And I also think the one little thing that I thought was pretty cool was that there was a police officer or a detective of some sort who, because they essentially found this. We forgot to mention this, but on the pizza bomber, there was this like a bunch of papers with instructions for like everyone. Like, there was a whole packet of what was to happen. And it was like, if you're the police and you find this, if you're the pizza guy, like, here are the do's and the do nots, like all like pages and pages and pages of this stuff. And the treasure hunt that this pizza guy was on, if he were to successfully rob the bank, he was supposed to go to this certain place, and a detective was there and saw a blue van pull up and then pull away. And the blue van is kind of how they tied everything together in the end. And it took years and years, sadly. But I don't know. I thought it was good. It's just one of those like things where you're like, oh, I could spend a few hours learning about this truly bizarre crime. And I feel the better for it.
Yeah. I mean, I guess, like, that was maybe my, that sort of ties into, like, or my dissatisfaction with that, with the relation, like, trying to understand Marjorie, like, not even dissatisfaction, but just, like, or not a dissatisfaction with the film, but just the fact that I think on some level, you know, she's somebody that's not, you're not necessarily gonna understand, or not understand, like, feel that kind of, like, human, like, understanding of, that she's just this sort of, like, in some ways, this kind of monster, at least that's actually comes across in the film.
For sure.
And I mean, in a lot of ways, I mean, they talk about also that she has this sort of history of abuse herself and this history of mental problems. And I don't necessarily want to minimize those, but, I guess the bigger like thing that made it, I'm glad I watched it, but made me a little bit unsatisfied at the end was, I think, that part of this true crime format of like doing it in four episodes, and so it's, I think, probably about like 3 to 3.5 hours, like if you just watch them all together as I did, is that it's you, that gives you the time to really like kind of go down some of these like false paths and red herrings that the actual investigation did, and I think in the moment that makes for a more compelling narrative because it means that you're sort of following each development as it happens in the actual chronology. But like then at the end of it, I did have a little bit of feeling like, wow, like if this was like a traditional 2-hour documentary, I feel like it would have been, they would have sort of cleaned up a lot of it. And like, yeah, you know, like it would be tighter and not necessarily go down some of these like dead ends. And I felt, I guess, that even though we got so much detail, there were still so many questions I had in terms of like, so, I mean, one of the central questions of the last episode is the involvement of this pizza guy, Brian Wells, and whether or not he, you know, knew what he was doing, whether he was complicit in this bank robbery. And the filmmakers kind of come down on one side, but I don't actually think the evidence they present is 100% compelling. You know, like, I think you could make an argument either way still after watching the film, which is fine. I mean, that's how real life works. But, you know, there's a little bit of a feeling as a viewer where, like, wow, like, I've spent so much time in this case, and I still have so many questions, like, also, like, how did, you know, Bill and, what was her, shoot, I forgot her name already. Marjorie. How did Bill and Marjorie, like, because, like, part of, like, the crux of the whole thing is the fact that Bill decides to call the cops about this body in his freezer, and I think we never really get a satisfying answer of why he did that, because I think you could make an argument that if he hadn't done that, they would never have caught them.
Yes, absolutely. And, like, also, we never really, I think it's fair to say that Marjorie, made the decision that this was going to be the plan, and Bill was definitely involved because they make this, they put the pieces together that Bill's really good with his hands. He knows how to make a bomb if he wanted to. He's very handy and kind of clever in that way. But I think like that kind of brings us to I think this is a good segue into our next show as well, because the inability to get a real truth in these true crime docuseries, or even, you know, the fictionalized kind of version of the based on true events versions, is what leads this. It's kind of like what caught me right in this like cycle of watching all this true crime stuff. Cause you like never quite know. And you're like, oh, I got to start a new one, you know, and you never quite know what that Making Murder was the same way. Like we still don't, I mean, people have really strong opinions on Stephen Avery and whether or not he did or didn't do that, or whether or not the police framed him or whatever, but like we don't really know for sure. There's so much up in the air, you know what I mean, and all of that. And and I think that can get you into this thing. I think also the point you make about the length of these shows is really important, because if you think about it, Making a Murderer, which I think spurred a lot of this new wave of true crime stuff, Making a Murderer was supposed to be a film that was like two hours and change. And when Netflix bought it, they were like, no, like get the rest of your footage together and make it, I think it ended up being 13. It's either 10 or 13 episodes, but that was absolutely necessary, because in every single episode of Making a Murderer, there is a twist that you don't expect. Right. You know what I mean? Every single episode. It's like, this episode is about the rape from back in the day, and this episode is about the prosecutor randomly like sexually harassing people, and like, you know what I mean? It just like everything had a bump in the road, and I think all of that was important to tell the whole story, kind of, even though clearly the filmmakers wanted to kind of exonerate Stephen Avery, I believe. But you know, I think with lengthwise, with The Staircase, which you haven't watched, so I'll just like cover it briefly. But The Staircase was 13 or 14 episodes, and I can say undoubtedly that was too long, and I think this Evil Genius thing was also too long. I think a 2.5-hour film would have been fine. And so, yeah, so Staircase, just for those of you, we don't have to go into too much detail, but the general premise is there's this married couple. They have a bunch of kids, but none of them are their kids together. So I think it's like 6 kids from previous marriages, and then 2 of them were adopted. It's a little weird, but she falls down the stairs. Well, we don't know if she fell down the stairs, but she's at the bottom of the stairs dead. And no. He calls the police, and the police instantly kind of suspect him, even though he says that she fell down the stairs. And they're like, oh, it's just so much blood. Like, you wouldn't have that much blood from falling down the stairs. And it becomes this really intense legal battle. And then you look into his past and you find out that, like, you know, 15 years earlier, another woman who was a family friend of his was also found dead at the bottom of the stairs. And so it, like, brings in this whole nother layer of, you know, and the guy himself, he's Marjorie-esque, but even probably a little bit more creepy. I wouldn't say he's smarter, but he's definitely, like, more aware of other people, I think. Mm-hmm. And, like, the way he wiggles around it and, like, continues to, like, preach his innocence is just crazy. And it's really good. I would watch, like, the first 8 episodes and then back away if you want.
Interesting. Okay.
It stops being interesting after a while. It starts just being, like, a lot of, will he get out of jail? Will he not? Is he going to go to jail? Like, it's just, like, that kind of stuff. But the actual, like, mystery and the way that they have these people trying to prove whether or not she fell down the stairs or was murdered is just really interesting. And his kids kind of trying to rally behind him. But the one daughter that was her daughter from her previous marriage turns against him. And it was interesting. It's like a cheap Making a Murderer. And I think people should watch it. I thought it was really, really good.
Really good for the first 8 episodes or so.
Yeah, it's just too long. That's the problem. Yeah. It's not that it's not an interesting story. It's not that he's not interesting, because he is. He is like a psycho. And his lawyers are really great. They're like interesting people to watch, you know, and like interesting people to the way that they approach dealing with a case like that. I always think those lawyers in criminal defense are, they might not be good people, you know, morally, but the way their minds work to kind of think of, okay, well, what are all the other scenarios in which this could have been the result? And how do we, you know, look at every little thing to figure out how we can get this person off? I don't know. It's just, again, like how different people's minds work. You know what I mean?
Right.
So I really like that. But Unabomber, you did watch an episode of Unabomber.
I did watch. Yeah, I watched one episode. And so this is not a documentary. This is a, you know, scripted series based on real events. And I think there's an attempt to, you know, to stick fairly closely with what we know about the real story. Yeah. And this is not originally not a Netflix show. It was a Discovery show, but it's now on Netflix.
Yeah. It's called Manhunt Unabomber.
Right, which is a very clunky title.
Yeah, I agree.
Oh, I was going to say, I mean, so just from one episode, I mean, it definitely feels like something where it's like just getting started and is kind of just getting off the ground. I mean, the one thing I really like is I'm just a big fan of Paul Bettany. And so it's interesting to see him play such a different role and to play.
Which one is he?
He's Ted Kaczynski.
He's Ted. Okay.
Yeah. And he's like, cause he's usually such a sympathetic character. Like, he's the Vision in the Marvel movies. He plays like Stephen Maturin in Master and Commander, which is one of my favorite movies. He was the villain in, I think, the Da Vinci Code, but like in general, he plays like these like nice, friendly British guys. And so to have him play this sort of psychopath is kind of interesting.
Well, but even like as a psychopath, like I think he elicits a lot of empathy.
Right.
Like, throughout the show, you've only seen one episode. But, like, so here's what I think is kind of the key to success for Manhunt, is that the Unabomber story, I think, even if you are too young to have grown up around that, you know, like I didn't even realize actually until watching it that I was alive for 10 years while he was still sending bombs to people. And I actually got on the phone with my mom and dad and I was like, why did you never, like, why weren't you paying attention to the Unabomber? Like, I have no recollection of you caring about the mail, but that seems like something that would have been really scary for 17 years. Like,
yeah,
anyone could get a package that could explode. That's terrifying. Are you kidding me? And they were like, oh yeah, it was just like, whatever, you know, like, I just didn't pay. It wasn't like OJ, you know? And I was like, oh, okay, great. But yeah, like, I think what's cool about it is there's so many documentaries, there's so many books, what's it called? Not manuscript,
Manifesto.
Manifesto is out there and people read it, you know, and like, it's this tale of legend almost in a way. But we don't actually, like, how many photos are there of Ted Kaczynski? Like, how many pieces of video do we have of him? Like, he had this such a solitary kind of hidden life out in this cabin. And the same goes for the FBI investigation. Like, we probably have a bunch of documents and stuff, but it's never, I don't think it's ever really been brought to life the same way, where you really see, you see, one, they tell it through the lens of the idea that forensic linguistics is becoming a thing. It's a new field, a new way of getting a hold of the Unabomber. And that I believe is very true, that the only thing that helped us catch the Unabomber, us, I was definitely there, was, yeah, I was the chief of the forensic linguistics department. No, but like that they used his manifesto and they used his letters and they used the way that he speaks and writes to find him. And I don't think that had been done before. And the FBI, you know, most of the higher ups at the FBI were like, we just got to wait for forensics. We got to wait for a fingerprint. We got to, you know, wait for him to use a credit card on one of these pieces or something, but he was too good for that. And then at the same time, a little bit more information on Ted Kaczynski, because I think a lot of the documentaries and the books written on him they focus a lot on how smart he was and his kind of belief system around technology, like imprisoning civilization. But they don't talk a lot about his past. And like he was smart. He was moved up a few grades. So he was always this little kind of runt little kid throughout all of his schooling, and he had trouble with women. You know, he was a virgin. He just, there were a lot of pieces to him that were, he felt like he had so much to say and no one was there to listen, you know? And, I don't know, just like kind of seeing those things come to life was interesting to me. And I thought it was really well done in that regard.
Mm-hmm. And since we were talking about length, I mean, so this is an 8-episode series. Did you feel like it was pretty compelling all the way through?
Yeah, I did. I thought that they did a good job. I think like maybe the last episode, you know, again, whenever they finally catch the guy, there's always one or two episodes about the trial.
Yeah.
I don't think there was a chance. I think so. Here, the interesting twist at the end is that are you really worried about me ruining?
No, I think real world spoilers are totally fine.
Yeah. So like the twist at the end, and this is true as well, is that because forensic linguistics was so nascent, they used the manifesto. They analyzed the shit out of his words, and the profile that they got from that was completely different from the profile that the FBI had been working off of. They thought he was uneducated, probably worked at an airline at some point, you know, and was just trying to terrorize people. And the linguistics told a very different story. They said, no, he's very highly educated. He's incredibly smart. He's probably lives in solitude. He might not even have a job. And the reason that they could tell that is like he, for example, the manifesto itself is written in this format that was only used at like a handful of colleges for like a 5-year period. So like he had to be in grad school. It was like the format that you use to write your like master's thesis or your PhD thesis for like 5 years. So they're like, he had to be in college, either getting his master's or his PhD at this time and at these colleges, right? And then he spelled certain words in a certain like style that was used only by like the Boston Tribune for like a 7 year period or something. So they're like, he has to, he read this from these years and he was in school at these years. He's highly educated, and they kind of flipped the profile on its head. And then when they released the manifesto and said, who writes like this? Who would say this? Who's told you about these ideas before? That's when Ted's brother came forward and said, it might be Ted. And that's how they found him. Now, none of that is evidence. Mm-hmm. Zero of that is actually evidence that leads back to Ted Kaczynski, right? Like, you can't use any of that in a court of law. But when they found his little shack or whatever, his little cabin in the woods, that original evidence that isn't actually worth anything led them to get a search warrant. And so Ted's whole thing was, yeah, you have all this evidence from the cabin, but if I can get that thrown out because your search warrant was invalid,
wow,
I'll get away with it. And it ended up coming down to the kind of head forensics guy, the one who really put in the work and really was the reason that he was caught. It comes down to him being like, you know, none of what you said and none of what you did will mean anything if you get off for not being the Unabomber. Like, you're just going to be a coward. You know what I mean? And it all kind of ends up coming back to that. But they also layer in, and I'm not sure how true this is, but they layer in this whole thing about this FBI agent kind of falling for Ted Kaczynski in a way. Like, thinking of him as like there's this bit about, you know, Ted goes into all this detail about cars. He's like, cars were meant to give us more freedom. We can go anywhere in the world. But then cities were built around cars. And then you had to have one. And you have to spend the money on that and insurance. And you have to follow the rules of the road, of the red lights and the stop signs and the using your turn signal. It actually like made us less free. And there's this whole thing about this FBI agent, every time he sits at a red light, getting kind of like filling with rage at the idea of being like a prisoner in society. And he kind of falls for what Ted is preaching the whole time, which I'm not sure how true that part is. I think that was like might have been a layer that they decided like, oh, let's make this even weirder.
Yeah, I get the sense that when, especially with these scripted shows, that there's some, especially like a level of license in terms of how they portray the police, the law enforcement officers, just to make them a little bit more interesting and compelling as like the sort of center of the show. But that said, it looks like the FBI agent, he was a consultant on Manhunt Unabomber, so presumably if he was really unhappy with it, he could have said something about it.
Yeah, and maybe he did, you know, because like I think honestly, I was talking to a couple people about this recently, that like, one, Ted Kaczynski's manifesto is not groundbreaking by any stretch. There have been philosophers and writers who have said the same thing about technology and, like, you know, technological progress imprisoning us and, like, taking away our freedom. That has been said for centuries. But I think there are a lot of people who don't necessarily disagree with his ideas. And I think also if he had been given an opportunity, I might be wrong in this. You know what I mean? I don't know Ted. But, like, if he had been given the opportunity to be heard, if his life had not been so, if he hadn't been so shunned for being a little socially awkward, and he could create friendships and love, and I think the series hits this home, so maybe this is the series doing and not necessarily the truth, but the series really makes it clear that, like, if he had had love in his life, and he had had someone to talk to, he's so smart. He has all these ideas. If he had just had someone to listen and have a conversation with him about it, it might not have escalated to what it did.
Right.
But he was so tired of not being heard. It really came down to, you know, forcing his words into the New York Times and the Washington Post, right? Like, he just wanted people to care what he had to say. And there's actually a long scene at the end of the show where Ted is, he realizes that. He says, like, I spent the last 17 years making bombs and writing my thoughts down, And everyone else spends those years of their life finding a wife and having a child and loving, and they fill their life with love in that regard instead of what I did. You know what I mean? I'm not sure if Ted ever had that realization or not, but I do think it's true that if he had found, you know, friends or a woman or man or whatever he was into, to kind of like love him and hear him, it would have been different. But yeah, I thought it was an excellent series. I really, really liked it. I'm glad that someone recommended it to me, and I tore through it.
Cool. And then I think you mentioned also that you've been watching Mindhunter. Is that right?
Yeah, Mindhunter is an original, right? It's a Netflix.
It's a Netflix original. And again, but based on a true story.
Is it?
Yes. I'm pretty sure.
I don't know if the... So, like, I think that it's based on a true story in that there was a team of people at the FBI who coined the term serial killer and tried to... And we're spending time trying to understand the profile of a serial killer, because I think for a long time, people didn't really understand that kind of murder. It was always like, this guy swindled me out of money, so I shot him. Or, like, you know, these crimes of passion or rage, you know, or like he cheated on me, so I stabbed him or whatever it might be. But it wasn't the idea that someone could think like they didn't really understand sociopaths. Mm-hmm. Right. And so there was a group of people trying to figure that out. I'm not sure if like on an episode to episode basis or like a case by case basis. It's true.
I'm looking now, like, and it seems like. Yeah, so it's based on this book, which is like you said, the development of this sort of approach to, you know, understanding serial killers. But at the same time, it does look like, I mean, even just like the main characters are based loosely on people from this FBI unit, but like even their names have been changed, which I think is, an indication that this is meant to be sort of a very fictionalized depiction of something that may sort of loosely be true.
Yeah. So I think that what makes Mindhunter interesting is that, well, one, gotta say that the main character, I don't know his real name, but he was in that Queer as Folk, I think.
Jonathan Groff, who was in Looking.
Looking, that's what it is. It's the new Queer as Folk. I didn't expect this from him, because like in Looking, he's such this kind of like baby-faced gay. He's like so sweet. He's like a little teddy bear, you know? And in this, he's like this kind of psycho. Like, he's a little bit too into his job, which is they essentially create this team that interviews violent criminals to try to understand, okay, well, what made you think this way? What did you feel before you committed the crime? What did you feel after you committed the crime? When did you decide you were going to commit the crime? You know, like, were you organized or disorganized? All of these kind of pieces to help them understand what would make someone do it. And it is so unsettling, I'll tell you. I would rather see a show where it showed serial killers committing serial killings than to watch, like, I say that, but I'm here watching all of Mindhunter. But like, this show is just these actors are playing serial killers, and they're sitting in a prison talking to these FBI guys about why they want to kill people. And that to me is so much more unsettling than an actual crime. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, the way that they talk about it, like it's nothing, or like it's something, or it's gruesome in the dialogue alone, right? Like, it's just, it's intense. It really, really is.
It seems like in some ways it's appealing to that same thing that you're talking about, it like this mindset that's so completely alien. It's actually like in some way trying to explore that and make it, you know, something that you can sort of at least try to understand.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you'll never really understand it, I don't think, unless you are, right? Like, I don't think it's... And the way that it takes over these guys, they talk about, like, you know, the actual amount of strength and confidence it takes to, like, strangle someone, for example. Like, you don't really think of that. You know, like, I don't. I never, like... I know that people get strangled. I know that you could strangle someone, but like, you never really think about like the actual like force it takes to do that, and the time it takes to do that, and like, I don't know. It's just this weird world, right? Of like the, and there's these people out there. There are serial killers out there who are doing this stuff. And trying to understand the psychology behind it is just like, it's this crazy weird world. It's this huge mystery, especially in the 70s when this is, you know, when they were actually trying to figure it out. It's a good show, but it's not like a before bed show. Like, I'll say that. Like, it is, there are some parts that are just very, very upsetting. And it's not because you're seeing graphic pictures or graphic killings. It's because these people are talking nonchalantly about these horrible, horrific things. And you're like, what the hell? You know, like, it's just very upsetting, but it's a good show for sure. And there are some cool style things to it too, that I really like. So.
Yeah. So, like, of all the shows that we've talked about today, Evil Genius, The Staircase, what's it, Manhunt, Unabomber, and Mindhunter, which one would you recommend the most, or say is, like, sort of the one that people should watch first?
Well, I think in terms of docuseries, first, Making a Murderer, honestly. If you haven't seen that yet, that is number one on the list across the board. But if we're talking about docs, probably Staircase. I think Staircase is better than Evil Genius.
Okay.
Even though it's long, I would quit like halfway through, but it's still really good. And then I would probably go with Manhunt, Unabomber. Like, Mindhunter's good. It really is, but it's like, I don't know, I think Manhunt, Unabomber is like so much more, it's like more grounded.
Mm-hmm.
We all know who the Unabomber is. Like, we've all seen that drawing. You know what I mean? Like, that Unabomber with the sunglasses and the hoodie. Like, it's this thing, right? That we can all kind of, we know the gist of it. And watching that play out on the screen across 8 episodes, like, I think was just like a really cool thing. It was really interesting. Seeing like Ted, like, even like they show some of the bombings, which is obviously hard to watch, but at the same time, like, there's no footage of any of his bombings ever. You know what I mean? Like, at least like with the Oklahoma City stuff, like, we saw that, like, there's tape of it, right? Like, I don't know. It's just, I think that Manhunt, Unabomber is probably the one I would recommend in the fiction series, but I still think people should watch Mindhunter if they're into this sort of content.
Right.
I hope my main hope is that I don't sound like a psycho on the podcast.
I think
we're inching towards that.
On that. by the way, that reminds me, one other thing I wanted to say about Evil Genius that was kind of crazy and that we should maybe even warn people about is that, like, and I don't think it's a secret that, like, we've basically acknowledged that, like, the bomb that's on his neck does go off, and, like, they show it, which is, like...
They show it twice.
Yeah, it's not, like, they blur it out, so you're not, like, it's not from a gore perspective, it's not, like, a lot, but it's still, like, incredibly upsetting, and I was kind of shocked that they
included. I was shocked, too. Yeah, I really was. They show it twice throughout the series, and you just... Even though he has a bomb strapped to his neck and he's saying it's going to go off, you just don't expect to see it. Like, you really don't. And it's just, it's very jarring for sure. So if that, you know, you might want to skip ahead a little bit or be on the lookout for it, or maybe not watch it at all, honestly, because it is very upsetting.
Cool. Well, that has been our tour through recent true crime on Netflix.
It's sunny and beautiful outside, but I feel down now.
Yeah. Let's go outside and try to, you know. Be glad that we haven't been murdered or murdered anyone, as far as I know.
No, I'm good. I'm clean.
Just a reminder to our listeners that they can subscribe on Apple Podcasts or any other podcast app. If you enjoy the show, you can also leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We'd really appreciate it. And thanks for listening.
Yeah, thank you guys. See you soon.